You need to, you, companies need to have this compliance program or have visibility into their data almost at their fingertips. So those are the things that get me excited and rather fired up.
That was Vince Walden, CEO of Kona AI. This is Tom Fox. Welcome to the award-winning Data-Driven Compliance. In this podcast, we will discuss how to use data to improve and enhance the effectiveness of your compliance program, creating greater business efficiency, all leading to more return on investment for your compliance program. Join host Tom Fox as he explores how data will drive your compliance program to the next level. This podcast is sponsored by Kona AI. And now a word about Kona AI. Kona AI is the leading AI-driven solution for anti-corruption, risk, and compliance professionals. Our easy-to-use software and flexible, secure deployment models drive fact-based decisions that focus on the risk areas that matter to the regulators and your business. Whether you are looking for a solution that sits in the cloud or on-premises, Kona AI returns lost money to your company's balance sheet and spots high-risk payments to third parties in half the time and half the cost. Conduct better evidence-based risk assessment. Reduce investigations costs. Enable your compliance team to present risk in a timely, data-driven, fact-based manner. Register for your free demo at konaai.com or email info@konaai.com. Today we begin part one of a two-part podcast series on a discussion with Tappan Debnath and Andrew McBride. Tappan is with ABB and Andrew's with Albemarle. They discuss their journey through data analytics in an FCPA enforcement action. This is part two. I hope you'll check out part one, which was posted last week. Today, we conclude with part two of our special two-part podcast series on data-driven compliance at ABB and Albemarle.
Follow up with you is, what were some of the sort of high-level challenges that you and your team at ABB had to work through? And then, Andrew, I'll pitch that same question to you.
Okay, Tom, I'll keep this one a little bit more brief. So one clear and obvious challenge is just around, really, we have great ideas. We want to do this and we want to get to there. But sometimes there's a little bit of lack of clarity of, you know, exactly what is it that you want to do. So having a really clear defined goal and process steps to get there, I think is really important. The way data is hosted for us and probably for a lot of organizations is in lots of different places. And there needs to be a lot of kind of data cleanup before we can utilize and use data. That's another one. A third challenge for us has been also getting hold of data in different jurisdictions. And let's say there may be data privacy laws around data transfer. There may be blocking statutes around this same thing as well. And so navigating the local law requirements around data transfer, getting a hold of the data, all of those things have been key challenges. Resourcing internally how to do this, getting the external stakeholders to support as well. These are really key fundamental steps I think need to be ironed out and looked at really early doors.
And Tappan, if I can comment on this too, and for the audience, in fact, I was just talking to a company this morning on this topic, is that because we're doing many these proactive monitoring, you don't have to have perfection be the enemy of good. And because this is not an audit, this is not a financial statement audit, and it doesn't have to, the data doesn't have to be perfect and 100% complete in order to get started. One of the observations that we have with both your companies too, is that it's a journey. This is not a project. A project is a defined start and stop type of deal. This is more of a business process, which it's going to start off at the beginning and you're going to have some good tests and results perhaps. And then it's just going to get better over time and the models are going to get better and the data quality gets better. And Andrew, I think you've seen that with your data too, is the journey that you've taken. It's so much better now than it was 6 months or a year ago, even just in terms of the data cleanup, right? It's a journey. It doesn't necessarily stop. And so it doesn't have to be perfect day one. And because oftentimes I see companies wait months or weeks for the data to finally get perfect before they get started. No, just get started. And then improve. And that's when you learn and you get better. And over time, and Andrew, you mentioned data quality improves because you just get better at it. And the reporting gets better and you get more ideas once you start using it. So my point there is, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. I think that's what they say. I think that's what the saying goes. I probably got that saying wrong, but.
So Vince, literally, you know, my first kind of bullet in my notes is be wary of perfection. And I was exactly going the same place, is that in some respects, those pitfalls are not necessarily a bad thing, because that's where you learn. And you just learn, you just fail fast. And there have been some dashboards that we may have put together that haven't worked for whatever reason. Maybe it's the data quality challenges. Maybe it's, you know, that it doesn't meet that so what test, right? You've done a dashboard, but people aren't using it, which raises the question, do you actually then need that and all of the work being put into creating the dashboard? And then to Vince's point, it is an iterative process. So many of our dashboards, we started and then we refined and we improved. And actually that's part of the fun, is seeing how you can make the quality of the information and the story that the data is telling you richer and richer. And that point about the project, I was smiling because, you know, in the earlier days where we were working with a contractor, they were putting pressure on me to define the start, the middle, and the end of the project in which project the team were working on. And I'm like, it's not like that. It's a lot more flexible. It's a lot more fluid, a lot more nimble in terms of how we are going to create these. And so that flexibility is key. I would also say that we're a Fortune 500 company with 8,000 employees. We do not have, within the ethics compliance team, a huge like data analytics team. We have one data analyst, or two now, and we have the great support from our IT department. And so I wouldn't want people to think that to develop a really great ethics compliance program, you need a cast of hundreds to be able to do this. If you've got the support, particularly of your IT function, and you've got the right roles doing the right thing, then it's possible.
Andrew, if I could follow up with one of the points you made very early on, which was utilizing data analytics as a control. That's not something that we really talk about, or at least we haven't evolved to having that discussion on an ongoing basis. So I wanted to ask you to maybe, if you could say a few words about how you've been able to utilize that. And then we had a question come in that's related to that point, which is, could a company set up an AI program which would at least assist as a control in the fraud, risk management, and compliance arena?
Yeah. So I think I go back to that kind of the so what, right? So when you're running data analytics, there has to be some sort of thing that happens. And so I mentioned earlier, there are some situations where you can hardwire a control that triggers to a reaction. Obvious examples of that are sanction screening. If there's a flag on a counterparty and there's an automatic kind of temporary block until it's been reviewed and cleared, that's a great example of data analytics and then the control being the block, the temporary block on the third party. And it's the same then with the integration between our third-party risk management platform and Salesforce. The salesperson cannot issue a quote until all of the boxes have been ticked on the third-party due diligence certification side. Then going back to that so what question, you're generating analytics perhaps from a transaction monitoring point of view. You've really got to be careful about the resources that are needed then to actually review the results. So for any analytics exercise that we're doing, you have to be thinking, what are we actually going to do with this data? It can't just sit there and no one look at it. You've actually got to review it. And then if you are reviewing it, who's doing the review? And is there a challenge with false positives? If the team is then being drowned in a whole wave of false positives, then it becomes almost counterproductive. And so this is where the segue to AI comes in, because in my mind, I don't mind the team starting out with a new AI-infused algorithm. And yes, there may be a relatively high number of false positives at the start, but if through provision of feedback, the algorithm gets better and better at identifying the genuine transactions of concern, then it frees up my team to be focused on other areas. And so I see AI as a means to actually improve the effectiveness of the monitoring and to reduce the burden on the team that are doing the follow-up. Now, here at Albemarle, we don't have that AI kind of capability on the transaction side. And we looked at the range of providers and we selected Kona AI. And part of that reason was because of not only the benefit of the improvements to our own algorithm, but through the participation of the broader Integrity Distributed Consortium, we were getting the benefits of feedback from other companies and what they were, what the results from their algorithms were feeding in and then indirectly benefiting us as well. That to me was a very compelling cost proposition rather than trying to do it in-house. Was to go
ahead. And Tom, if I can comment real quick on this too, there's a lot of questions coming in on, you know, how is AI being used? And it's actually, it's funny. I do a lot of writing for Fraud Magazine and it's going to be the March issue. It's interesting. And for those on the call, to put things in context of how AI practically, there are three categories of analytics maturity. There are the descriptive analytics, and this is just classic, you know, old Gartner. You know, there's descriptive analytics, which are the rules-based tests, and that's the foundation. We all use rules-based tests. And then as you train the model and as you tag transactions, just like in the old email days when you find a smoking gun email and you say, find me more like this using technology-assisted review, the same concept works for transactions. When I find high-risk transactions and the team tags it, that is predictive analytics. Find me more like this, statistically similar. And that's where the integrity distributed model, gosh, and we owe an update on that because at the time we processed about $75 billion worth of transactions across the corpus. And right now it's over $150 billion. There's a lot of data in there that are now being tagged to use to train the model. But prescriptive analytics was still very hard and we weren't able to really get it. And prescriptive analytics is not just what's going to happen, but what should we do about it? What are the five things that we recommend to the user? And this is where the chatbots come in, perhaps, where we think about, and again, you can see this on the demo site, but now very soon, chatbots will be pushing the dashboards. And I say that very soon, like 2024, instead of clicking on a Tableau or Power BI dashboard, you're going to be talking to a chatbot and hey, show me my highest risk transactions between this date range and this date range that have the word training in it or whatever. It will then push and navigate you. That will drive the dashboard. And then of course, was that helpful? Yes or no, that trains it. But that's still not prescriptive. Interestingly, with generative AI and the building of large language models, and again, many of us are being asked by our stakeholders or IT, what's compliance doing around AI or generative AI? Interestingly, without having to send data out to OpenAI, you can build these domain-specific large language models that would then perhaps, like what if we could take every single DOJ and FCPA enforcement action and every single, I'll say Tom Fox podcast or Tom Fox book or everything that was written about our company's policies and procedures and thresholds and put that into your own LLM that could then be integrated with your payments. Again, this is visionary, but this is 2024 kind of thinking in the coming months, what's ahead? And it's really exciting to think, all right, now not only can I have a predictive of what's going to happen, but here are the five things that we should do about it based on case history and what the DOJ has done in the past, based on my company's policies, based on what the transactional data is telling me. That's the top of the pyramid. And it's an article I'm writing on in Fraud Magazine in March that goes from can LLMs finally get us to prescriptive analytics. We tried it before. I wrote an article. We tried piloting it with GE many years ago, back in 2018, where we tried to do it called Digital Twin. It was hard, but with an LLM, it might just work. Tom's helping us build it and we invite others to contribute, but stay tuned. And I just wanted to, in answering the question of where AI is going in compliance, again, that's not the only place, but that's an example of how we think it can finally get us to prescriptive analytics through generative AIs and large language models.
Tom, if I may very quickly just build on something that Andrew mentioned just now about, okay, you've got your tool, which is doing the transactional analysis, is coming up with red flags. What do you do with the red flags? And absolutely, you need to have that resource capability to be able to review the red flags and so on. And just sharing an example at ABB, we've had instances of our tool picking up red flags, which have then been assessed by the analytics team and then passed on to the investigations team. And the investigations team have actually conducted a review and come out with some findings and so on. So it is picking up issues in that sense as well.
Let me just stay with you, Tappan, and ask what if someone, a compliance professional, a chief compliance officer, perhaps even a board of director, wanted to start the journey that ABB has been on, do you have, how would you counsel them to start their journey?
So look, I think a lot of this has been spoken about previously, which is you've got to start somewhere. And don't worry about making mistakes. Don't worry about having, as Vince and Andrew have been saying, a perfect place to start off from, a launch pad where your data is nice and there's no kind of anomalies and so on. Make the jump. It's going to be worth it. And Andrew made a really fantastic point, which is doesn't matter about the size of your organization. If there's willing, please just push it through because it's going to add value, no doubt.
And Andrew, if I could ask you, in the journey that you and your team have been on, how would you counsel a company now starting? We've talked a lot about it's the journey, not the destination. We've talked about, Tappan just said, start somewhere. Talked about, or Vince talked about, let the perfect get in the way of the good. And I know you and your team have been on this journey for some time, but how would you counsel the company who is starting that journey?
So I think that, you know, you have to think about like finite resources. And so you have to prioritize where you're going to focus. So if you're going to start small, where do you start? And that's going to be driven by several factors. So your risk profile clearly is one, the amount of resource that you have available to support the analytics effort, whether it be within compliance or in partnership with IT or outside dependency, the quality and the accessibility of the data. I will say that there are many compliance peers, when I've told them that we have one global iteration of SAP, they get quite emotional about that. I mean, it was a massive kind of boost to us being able to move quicker. But other companies, they're not so lucky. They may have anything up to 30 or 40 different ERP systems. And so then that kind of necessarily lends you to perhaps focus on one or several rather than the complete totality. And then also being thinking smart, being driven by your audience. So one of the key philosophies that we have instilled in designing any new dashboard is, yes, I might have a need for a dashboard and my audience might be the compliance team as part of our execution of the ethics and compliance program. But can I, if we're doing this data analytics exercise, can I help other stakeholders by sharing that information or improving on the information that they already have? So for example, two examples of that would be travel and expenses. I want to have a T&E dashboard to monitor for fraud, corruption, but we also share that same T&E data or similar version of it with management as a cost control measure and then a health and safety measure of where are our employees traveling around the world, which was actually very relevant during COVID. Secondly, thinking about using a particular data analytics use case for multiple compliance purposes. So pricing monitoring clearly is very important from an anti-corruption point of view when you're looking at the issue of discounts and the like, but then it's also a very effective tool from an antitrust risk management perspective as well. If you're looking at different kind of pricing trends throughout the year, whether there's an explained activity, does that trigger a reaction? And then improving. So when we were working with our sales team on that pricing dashboard, we realized that the work that they were already doing to track their sales only went down to a certain depth. And we wanted to get down to the individual SKU level. So we actually helped them improve their data set. And so from a branding point of view for ethics and compliance, it's almost as if we have become a data analytics service to other functions to help improve their offering, their data analytics solutions. It makes us look good, but it also helps us use their information for our own compliance purposes.
Let me just follow up with a little bit different direction. What are some of the questions the people who are overseeing your compliance function asking? So whether it be a regulator, whether it be an internal auditor, whether it be an external auditor, what are they asking in terms of documentation to demonstrate the effectiveness of your programs? And let me start with you, Andrew.
Yeah, I think that we were talking earlier about successes and the use of data. And I think one that I would want to particularly focus on is another example of the so what and then the associated documentation. Now, because of the various data analytics use cases that we have developed over the months and years, we've got this really like rich data set that can help inform a much richer risk discussion. So the DOJ talks about the importance of risk assessment and not, you know, moving away from the concept of the snapshot risk assessment. That's something that we're very much embraced in that perhaps in the old days, the concept of the risk assessment is that you would have someone go visit an office once a year, and that would be the opportunity to go and learn information about what's going on at that site. We've flipped that on its head, where we do have those site level engagements with local leadership, but we come to those conversations armed with information. We have access now to much more information that leadership does not have about their own operations. And so we combine that objective data from transactions and from investigations and from training, along with some local employee surveys, and then we democratize that information with that local leadership. And it's amazing to see then the discussion being sparked about what should we do about what is this data telling us? And we in compliance will come with our own views, but it's amazing to see site leadership reacting to the data and having their own perspectives, as they rightly should. And to the point about documentation, we have that data documented. We have the engagement material with the local leadership team documented. And then the remediation that comes out of those discussions is also tracked through to completion. And that to me has been one of the real values of the data that we have collected in its totality.
And Tom, can I add something to Andrew's comment? Because I wanted to give a shout out, because this was what Assistant AG Nicole Argentieri commented at the November ACI FCPA conference. And I'd like to just read this quote from her, because I was asked by an editor to comment on this. But she said, and representing the DOJ, just as we are upping our game when it comes to analytics, we expect companies to do the same. In fact, we cited Albemarle's NPA, its use of data analytics to monitor and measure its compliance program's effectiveness, as an example of its extensive remediation. Companies have better and more immediate access to their own data, and you can be sure that if a misconduct occurs, our prosecutors are going to ask what the company has done to analyze or track its own data, both at the time of the misconduct and when we are considering a potential resolution. And again, that was a pretty clear shout out to compliment to you or to the Albemarle program, but it was just plain as day clear that's an expectation now. And having a documenting the tests that you run, the activities that you do, the data sources that you have is very important, I think, in terms of building that program, not just doing the analytics, but showing you how you took that risk-based approach and documented the process.
Kevin, if I could follow up with you, we've had a question that comes in, I think is probably directed towards you, because you made the point about the difference in data and insights and delivering insights. And could you give an example or two where you felt like the insights delivered really helped in either the business unit or in an area, as opposed to simply just reporting data to some group or function above you?
Yeah. So look, it's quite easy to use the various dashboards and so on to produce some nice graphics around what's going on, investigations on guest travel and hospitality, transactionally, et cetera, et cetera. But what is that data actually showing? What are the insights and what are the actions, the actionable insights from that data? Maybe as an example, what we've found from doing a kind of ABB group-wide analysis is that there's certain risk themes coming up across the business. And this isn't isolated to one part of the business, it's across the board. So those risk assessments could be, for example, a geographical hotspot or trending area. It could be where misconduct involves a certain type or a certain kind of topology, if you like, where it's using third parties, whether it's on the supply, on the buy side or on the sell side. Or it could be, for instance, where we see a lot of misconduct being driven by a certain level of management, whether it's at the middle level. Those types of insights, the value we're bringing to the business, the insights we're bringing to the business is first and foremost, telling them about it so they know where the risks are. And then coming up with some actions to address those risks. So if you're seeing, as we are, some geographical issues, what do we need to do in that geography to address those risks in that business? So coming up with action plans around those identified risks, but then looking at it from a strategic point of view as well, rather than just keeping it at that kind of tactical, actionable level. So what else is going on in the business where you're addressing similar types of issues and coordinating this strategically, so you're delivering most effective learnings, communications, trainings, whatever it is to deal with those, whether it's also enhancing your controls, for instance. So if it's adding another layer of control because you're seeing certain issues in a certain geography. So those types of insights, which then go to minimizing risk and at the same time, ensuring that the business can continue in a risk-managed way.
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode. I'm going to give a shout out to the Kona AI sponsored podcast, Data-Driven Compliance, because we talk about these issues every week. So I hope our listeners will check out the podcast. And with that, Vince, I'm going to send it back to you for some closing remarks. You're on mute, Vince.
Yeah, whoops. First off, Andrew and Toppin, thank you, gentlemen, for your comments and your time on this. And Tom, as always, you're a great moderator and it's fun having you on, and you've done this a few times, so it's always smooth and runs great. I want to also appreciate the questions. There was a lot of questions. I think we answered most of them and there's a couple more in there, but we'll be sure to follow up and answer the questions in the group. And for everybody who gave us their hour's time, a great thank you. You will get a copy of the link of this podcast so that you could share it with your colleagues or your stakeholders in your organizations. Because again, we want to get the word out. Data-driven compliance is an expectation. It's frankly, it's a lot of fun. And I think 2024 is really going to be a breakthrough year. Remember, generative AI only came out in November of 2022, and we've really only had a year to digest it. And even the tools, we're trying to develop some of these things, and even the tools to develop them are changing as fast as the innovations and use cases. So it's even hard to even keep up with the tools because they change almost monthly. It's just getting better and better. So there's, I think, a lot of good use cases for it. But again, it's not about using AI for the sake of AI. It needs to drive a decision or solve a problem. And so practical use cases is key. Andrew Tappan, any closing remarks from your end?
And the only thing I would say, and I suspect Tappan agree, to the extent that people are going through their ethics and compliance data analytics journey and they want to kick the tires, sound, but happy to, you know, by all means, reach out. Happy to help out.
Yeah, Vince, I echo this as well. I'm more than happy to take a call and just discuss things. But otherwise, just to say thank you again.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the award-winning Data-Driven Compliance. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope you'll subscribe, rate, and review wherever great podcasts are listened to. Data-Driven Compliance is a special production of the Compliance Podcast Network. This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the award-winning data-driven compliance. If you didn't check out part one of our special two-part podcast series, I hope you'll go back and check out last week's episode number one. Also, I have white papers on both the ABB and Albemarle FCPA settlements. So if you'd like those, you can shoot me an email at tfox@tfoxlaw. I'm happy to share both of those white papers with you. I hope you will join me again next week for another episode of Data-Driven Compliance.